business and an extra $250 a month in her pocket. Despite being just 14 years old, Emily had spent hundreds of hours locked away in her kitchen laboratory with her father, David, creating spice blends. They would play around with ingredients, trying to come up with a hot new seasoning that would blow the competition out of the water, or at least off the table. For her class project turned business, Emily wanted to officially make and bottle her own spice. This challenge required multiple attempts. Upon cooking one of her initial recipes, the entire family had to vacate the house for a day, leaving all the doors and windows opened. After Spicegate, Emily and David went to talk with experts at another local business, the Savory Spice Shop. This is where she gave her project a name, Red Spice. After receiving the class assignment, she went back to the staff of the Savory Spice Shop once more to enlist their help in turning her hobby into something more. It was there she learned her first real lessons in business. The shop's co-owner, Janet, offered a beneficial exchange. If Emily could make the product more accessible to people and reduce the amount of money she spent on making each vial of the spice, the shop would put it on the shelves for sale. Going back to the drawing board, Emily managed both to find a similar blend of spices that more people could eat without their eyes watering, and to bring the manufacturing cost of each mixture down to $2.74. That same recipe now stands on the shelves of the shop, retailing at $6 a bottle. Safe in the knowledge that she'd passed her class assignment, it was now time to take Red Spice to a wider market. But to do that, she was going to need more money, and she didn't want to take it from her current investor, her dad. So she decided to crowdfund her project through Kickstarter. David and Emily wrote a campaign description, made a video, and set about raising $1,500 to cover expenses. After just a few weeks of word-of-mouth marketing and getting her story featured in a local newspaper, the project raised $2,760. The school project is long since over, but Emily is still heating up. Red Spice now offers three products, the original five-spice product from her project, a slightly hotter 10-spice blend, and a cooking rub. Of the $250 a month she made during the first year, Emily is yet to spend any of it personally. She's investing it back into the business and into her college fund, resisting the urge to buy the hot tub she's always wanted. Spice-wise, she's focusing on getting the product in local restaurants, reaching out to farmers markets, and creating more bottles to put on the retail shelves. It's a business model with a real kick. Critical factor: Emily upgraded her school project to a fiery hot side hustle. By telling her story in a crowdfunding campaign, she was able to cover 100% of the expenses. Florist and sculpture professor team up to make presidential lip balm. A gift idea for family and friends blossoms into a full-fledged lip balm biz. Megan Lucky is a freelance sign language interpreter and florist living in Springfield, Illinois. Her side hustle is making all-natural lip balm. She runs it with her business partner and former teacher, Cara Koffel, a sculpture professor at a nearby college. The business started by accident when Cara wanted to make lip balm as Christmas gifts. On the way back from visiting her parents, she looked on Pinterest for recipes. Then she ordered small amounts of each ingredient. Cara convinced Megan to help her. They began playing around with the ingredients. They found that it wasn't that hard to make a decent balm. Before long, they were making batches in Cara's kitchen, giving them away to people they knew. Their friends and family asked for more, so they ordered additional tubes and ingredients and decided to charge to cover their costs. Next, Cara heard about a coffee shop in town that was changing locations and looking for items to sell. They sent a message to the owner, who agreed to let them give it a try. After creating labels for what they called serious lip balms, they started selling wholesale and at vendor fairs. At one of those fairs, they met the woman who manages the gift shop for the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, located right there in Springfield. She liked the balms and wanted to sell them in the shop, but there needed to be some connection to the president. Abe Lincoln wrote down a lot of notes, but unfortunately, he'd never said much about his favorite lip balm. So instead, Megan and Cara took home some recipes of his favorite desserts, and they matched their scents to those. The next time you're at the Presidential Museum, you can pick up one of their balms in your choice of Mr. Lincoln's lemon pie, Mrs. Lincoln's white cake, and Honest Abe's gingerbread. I think I'm going to go for the lemon pie. The first order was 150 balms, which they delivered on a Thursday. By Monday, the museum was reordering and placing orders for Gettysburg and Ford's Theater, two other Lincoln-themed shops. As they've been making balms for Honest Abe and other customers, they continued to work their day jobs. In year two, they made 3,789 balms. In year three, they made 42,496. When they first bought lip balm tubes, they bought 25. They now buy them 10,000 at a time. Megan has a 14-year-old son, and Kara's son is 3. Recently, a bunch of custom orders needed to be made on the weekend, and the kids jumped in to help out. Megan said it absolutely must be leaving some sort of impression on these boys to see their mothers making a business out of nothing and hustling their hearts out to make it happen. Surely America's first president would approve, at least as long as they saved him some lemon pie. Critical factor. A product like lip balm is widely available, and therefore it needs good branding to stand out. As they grew, Megan and Kara improved their labeling and began making custom blends, including the ones commissioned by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Mom and son protect family jewels in Heartland Hustle. A Kansas City area mom and her young son invent an essential product for young male athletes. Brandy Russell knows a lot about kids, both professionally and personally. By day, she's a pediatric occupational therapist. By day and night, she's a mother of 2. 3 summers ago, Brandy teamed up with her 11-year-old son, Kyler, becoming his business partner for a concept he had first imagined while playing Little League in a suburb of Kansas City, Missouri. The idea? A protective yet comfortable athletic cup for young male athletes, aptly named the Comfy Cup. Kyler loved baseball, but didn't love the bulky equipment that boys are required to wear when playing sports. From the shelves of their local sporting goods stores to the depths of online retailers, Brandy bought him every different athletic cup available on the market, but they were all a pain in the crotch. After weeks of protest, Brandy finally told Kyler, "If you don't like something, quit complaining about it and come up with a solution." Cue the Comfy Cup. Kyler came to his mom the very next day with the idea to invent an athletic cup that's soft, lightweight, and moves with your body. The mother and son team then crafted a one-of-a-kind, hand-sewn cup right in their living room, using foam, fabric, and Brandy's trusty sewing machine. Product testing was held right there in that same room, with both Kyler and his dad serving as models. Brandy assures us that no family members were harmed in the making of this product. This self-described, battle-tested, kid-approved arts and crafts project has come a long way since then. The Comfy Cup is now available from various online retailers, as well as their own e-commerce website. The entire Russell family now has a part-time job in the business of protecting the family jewels. Kyler and his 10-year-old sister, Ellison, work to fill orders before and after school. Throughout the day, Brandy weaves in conference calls and meetings between her scheduled therapy sessions with her clients. She also runs the brand's social media campaigns. This work ethic and entrepreneurial spirit seems to come naturally to her. She's also written 2 children's books as what she calls her side hustle. The Russells work out of their home office and use their basement as a warehouse. The Comfy Cup retails for $12.99. They pay $2.79 per product, which is now manufactured in Hong Kong, plus 60 cents per product for shipping. After miscellaneous seller and shipping fees, it comes out to a profit of $6.92 per product. Oh, side note, another expense is an annual charge of $1,200 for liability insurance. Given what the cup is protecting, it seemed like a good idea to get insured. They reached a big milestone 1 year after starting, when the business broke even. Sales are now consistently over $10,000 per month. Brandy says that the best part of the whole project is seeing her son's idea become a reality. She remembers when they produced their first 1,000 cups and she thought, how in the world are we going to sell all these? But then they were gone in just a few months. The Comfy Cup brand is now growing as a retailer and wholesaler. They've applied to Shark Tank and they have a proposal in with Walmart. The Russells also want to expand the product line to include sizing for tweens, teens, and even grownups. They're also thinking about venturing into other athletic equipment like shin guards, because while you're protecting one part of the body, you might as well protect them all. Critical factor. Lots of boys and young men play sports that require protection. Since so many of them were uncomfortable with the existing options, there had to be a better way. And it seems like Brandy and Kyler have found it. Woolly Mammoth inspires organic paleo bars. Frustrated by the lack of snack bars devoid of added sugar and weird ingredients they couldn't pronounce, 2 hungry fitness enthusiasts create their own tasty paleo bar and hustle their way to multiple 6 figures. Michael Winchell and Anthony Osland weren't trying to start a food business. They were just hungry. Michael, a financial analyst, and Anthony, a CrossFit instructor, both follow a paleo diet. Eager to eat well on the go, they were looking for a nutrition bar that was made out of real food. Their ideal bar wouldn't have any added sugar or weird stuff, and would still taste good. But despite the plethora of snack bars and supplements on the market, they couldn't find one that met their requirements. They began prototyping bars in their kitchen at home, using organic ingredients like sprouted nuts, coconut, dates, and egg white protein. Their friends and family loved what they were making, and they had to borrow more and more Cuisinart mixers as they continued to experiment. By the time they got to 5 Cuisinarts in their home kitchen, they realized that maybe they should consider renting space in a commercial kitchen. Their hobby was becoming an obsession. Renting space allowed them to produce the bars more easily and keep up with the demand from friends and family. But before they started selling the bars to strangers, they set up a blind taste test with the kind of people they hoped to sell to. They compared their recipe to 10 other bars that were similar, using a simple rating system that took several factors into consideration: taste, texture, and the all-important question, would you pay money for what's in your mouth? Based on feedback from their blind taste testers, they went through close to 100 iterations across 4 different flavors until they got their recipes dialed in. As Michael explains, this is a process that I think very few food startups actually go through, because they just assume that people will like what they make. We didn't assume anything. We tested it until we knew we had a winning hand. As it turned out, their target market preferred bars with less sugar and more real food. With their recipe set, Michael and Anthony were ready to scale up and introduce their paleo mammoth bars to the masses. The name refers to the legendary Woolly Mammoth. We doubt that he did much surrendering back in the day, Michael said, and we like that attitude when it comes to health and nutrition. So, with that liberation in mind, they introduced the Mammoth bars in a clear wrapper with a simple white label. They kept this packaging for over 2 years as they continued to grow their supply to meet increasing demand. During those years, they had to grapple with a lot of decisions, some of which they had anticipated and some they hadn't. They knew they were going to write their own content, design their website using Shopify, and do their own accounting. Those parts were straightforward enough. But as a food business, there were some additional puzzle pieces that had to be configured. They had to find organic suppliers, figure out what licenses they needed, and make sure they got all the proper inspections. And because they were set on being certified organic, they had to jump through even more hoops. As Michael and Anthony scaled up, they encountered a temptation to add preservatives or tweak their recipe to make it easier to create in a larger kitchen and thus extend the shelf life of the product. This is what many nutrition bar producers do, so it wouldn't be terribly unusual. But they made a decision early on that they would figure out a way to scale up without sacrificing quality, and to continue handling production themselves instead of outsourcing it. This meant that they were in the kitchen every weekend and many weeknights grinding out the bars. While they did almost everything themselves, their startup costs still added up. All told, they invested about $30,000 of their own money the first 2 years. Most of this investment, $20,000, went to ingredients and packaging materials. The remaining $10,000 was spent on leasing the kitchen space, website hosting, consultants for specialized topics like food science and manufacturing, and paying to rent space at events. As their audience continued to grow, they knew they needed a brand overhaul, something more than their initial clear packaging with a white label. So for phase two, they launched their product to a larger audience via Kickstarter. They set their goal at $10,000 and offered pledge levels from $5,000 to $1,000. In the very first day, they surpassed their goal and went on to raise over $50,000. This strong endorsement meant they could fully move forward with their rebranding. But at the same time, they now had to make a lot more bars than they'd ever made in such a short period of time. Prior to the Kickstarter campaign, their average monthly revenue was $6,000. To fulfill $50,000 worth of bars, they put in even more long weekends and all-nighters. Beyond just running a successful Kickstarter campaign, it also boosted their monthly revenue up to an average of $10,000. Even more significantly, they were approached by Pete's Coffee about carrying their bars in stores. Pete's tested their bars in 12 Sacramento area stores to great response at the end of the year. Early the next quarter, they began to roll out the bars to their stores nationwide. More recently, their monthly revenue has been hovering around $25,000, split evenly among Pete's Coffee sales, direct online sales, and sales at all other independent retailers. As big as those numbers sound, Michael and Anthony still both have their day jobs. They finally hired a couple of people to make the bars for them in their shared kitchen, but they say there's always something that needs to be tweaked. From improving a production process, finding backup suppliers, getting into a new retailer, or thinking about launching new flavors, they have their work cut out for them. And they wouldn't have it any other way. As Michael said, once things stop being a challenge, I think I'd probably hang it up and move on to the next project. But I'm guessing we'll never get to that point. Critical factor, the relentless testing that Michael and Anthony did, more than 100 iterations, gave them an edge over the many other nutrition bars on the market. They've also cultivated a loyal following through their extreme dedication to quality. This story includes an action plan. Step one, everything begins with the right recipe. Get in the kitchen and start experimenting. Step 2, find your target audience wherever they are: yoga studios, offices, gyms, or wherever is best suited to your product. Step 3, resist the temptation to assume that you know what your target audience prefers. Instead, follow Michael and Anthony's lead by conducting blind taste tests, comparing your product to those of competitors, and making adjustments after each round. This is a lot of work, but worth it in the end. Step 4, consider a crowdfunding campaign as a means of fundraising and getting more people involved. Lastly, step 5, improve the packaging as you go. Product comes first, but good branding will help you stand out. Side Hustle Labs, partnering up. Thinking about partnering up? Well, think again, or at least think carefully. For every partner story we feature on Side Hustle School, we have at least one that starts as a partnership before dissolving into a one-man or one-woman show. Why? Simply because when it comes to side hustles, almost inevitably, one partner will be more committed to it than the other. And if this isn't the case at the outset, it often changes as time goes by. All things being equal, if you have the choice between owning your idea completely or sharing it with a friend, it's better to own it yourself. This doesn't mean that you don't get help from others. Everyone needs help. It just means that going into partnership can add complexity to a process that should be simple. Now, clearly there are occasions when partnering up makes good sense. Just keep these principles in mind. It's usually best to partner with someone who has different skills and strengths than you do, and have a clear written agreement for what happens if one partner needs to move on. Following these principles will help you focus on the things that matter and perhaps avoid unnecessary conflict down the road. For more, visit sidehustleschool.com/partnership. Chapter 14, start your own factory. If you build it, will they come? Maybe, but first you have to build it. The people in these stories learned about sourcing, manufacturing, or both. Even complex projects, a boat and a backpack, can be done part-time without quitting your job. Corporate employee makes $350,000 selling anti-mosquito wristbands. When mosquitoes attack, this marketing manager creates a wristband to ward them off. The project is a swarming success. Matthew Konstanecki has always had a knack for knowing what would sell. As a marketing manager at a software company, his responsibilities involve seeking out small businesses that would benefit from having a better inventory management system. In his previous job, Matt was responsible for sourcing medical supplies and equipment from China. These experiences gave him the exposure and knowledge he needed for running his own business. He'd had several side hustles, but each of them ran their course and didn't produce a ton of money. He kept thinking that surely he could launch something more substantial. He just had to figure out what it was. The two problems Matt had to figure out were what to sell and how to sell it. The answer, at least in this case, was both strange and sensible. In his extensive travels, especially in the Caribbean and other humid places like Thailand, he found himself struggling with mosquitoes. With the airplane restrictions on liquids and aerosols, he kept looking for an anti-mosquito product that would be easy to travel with, yet still powerful and effective. He couldn't find such a product, so after much research, he decided to create a mosquito bracelet that would release geraniol oil, a substance that was proven to repel mosquitoes. He didn't invent the wristband idea, he simply branded it. Matt contacted potential suppliers through Alibaba and hunted for one that was willing and able to produce what he wanted. He then purchased generic wristbands, slapping a brand name on them to differentiate the product from the rest. Invisiband was his name of choice. The second challenge was figuring out how he would move his products from supplier to consumer. Searching for a distribution company, he stumbled upon Fulfillment by Amazon, a service that helps sellers store, pack, and ship their products. It even handled customer service and served as the perfect solution for Matt's needs. None of this would have mattered if Matt wasn't able to generate some sort of demand for his product. As a marketer, he understood this, so he listed his new wristbands on Indiegogo before he even sold them. His hunch that Invisiband would sell was quickly validated as he raised $12,315. Being successful with crowdfunding can be an art by itself, but the gist of what Matt did just came down to hard work. He says that the most common mistake people make is simply publishing their creation and hoping for an audience to come. Unfortunately, this isn't usually how it goes. Among other strategies, Matt was successful in searching for journalists and writers who had covered similar products, and then reaching out to them with a special angle. For him, that angle was under-promising and over-delivering. Backers of Invisiband could expect to receive a batch of 5 bracelets within 2 weeks of making a pledge of just $19. He had committed to manufacturing 2,000 wristbands before launching, to ensure that they would be instantly ready to ship when backers place their order. Now, side note here, delivering what you promise may not sound like a radical strategy, but the world of crowdfunding products is filled with skepticism after too many campaigns have let down their backers. So how did it go? Well, apparently a lot of people are annoyed by mosquitoes because the business grossed $647,244 in the first year. With profit margins of around 50%, Matt made over $350,000. For such a huge profit, startup costs were minimal. His first batch of product cost just $200 to manufacture, and he only scaled up production when demand for InvisiBan was validated. Matt's worst experience was having a $10,000 shipment seized at the border because of documentation issues, which almost crippled the business at that point in time. He had to fly down to the United States from Toronto and negotiate with border agents for them to release his goods. It worked out in the end, but it made for a stressful few days. True to the spirit of side hustling, Matt has now gone on to create two more brands in completely different niches. Both have since generated enough profit to replace an entire full-time income. In addition, he's expanded to consulting and helping other clients with product launches. His new winning streak has taken the sting out of those previous misses. Critical factor: anti-mosquito wristbands have been around for a while, but Matt branded his and created a strong marketing campaign combined with above and beyond customer service. On-the-go mouthwash gets mini makeover. Two Florida State grads create a mini mouthwash empire, selling 3,500 bottles in less than a year. Until two college students decided to rinse, swish, and repeat, the world of mouthwash hadn't seen a major innovation in the past 100 years. And it all started with a potentially embarrassing moment. Mike Brachiali found himself in the starring role of this moment while cramming at the library for an organic chemistry test. As most college students do, he was pulling an all-nighter, which involved copious amounts of coffee and food that should only be consumed with caution after age 25. He could have braved the storm, but as fate would have it, in walked his sophomore year crush. Since tables are in short supply around midterms and finals, she opted to share his. At any other time, Mike would have welcomed such an opportunity, but with the lack of a breath mint at hand, things were just a little too close for comfort. Feigning a desperate need to visit the restroom, Mike dashed home to freshen up before heading back to the library. We're not sure how Mike did on that chemistry test, and he didn't end up getting the girl. That's a story for another book, but he did walk away with a big idea. Around this time, students all over campus were walking around with small bottles of a concentrated flavored liquid that they used to spruce up water. While the bottle contained only about 1.62 fluid ounces, that was enough concentrated flavor to add to 24 8-ounce servings of water. With the struggles of bad breath fresh in his mind, Mike couldn't help but wonder why no one had thought to do the same with mouthwash. Being on a pre-med track with several years of chemistry under his belt, he knew that the average bottle of mouthwash was mostly just water. If he could find a way to take the water out of mouthwash, he could create a product that didn't yet exist. He'd also be able to save a ton of money on shipping, reduce the amount of plastic needed per unit, and target a group of people who might be thrilled to take advantage of a mouthwash that was capable of being on the go as much as they were. Despite his excitement about the idea, Mike didn't end up acting on it right away. Instead, he spent the next 2 years getting as much feedback as possible from friends, family, and fellow students. After he graduated, he moved to South Florida for graduate school, and then quickly realized that he wanted something different. That's when he started looking at his fresh breath idea with fresh eyes. Just as Rome wasn't built in a day, neither is an innovative mouthwash empire. Enter Nick Telford, Mike's fraternity brother and fellow mouthwash enthusiast. Nick was one of the people Mike had approached for feedback back in his fraternity days. He loved the idea of advancing the cause of fresh breath. They divided responsibilities, with Nick working on financing and brand development, while Mike focused on the product itself. The goal was daunting. It needed to taste at least as good as most mouthwash on the market. It had to have a major cleaning effect on your mouth. And it also had to be capable of being produced in a concentrated form. With each test run, they were able to get feedback, take it back to the lab, and pump out a new and improved version for testing. Swish, rinse, repeat. After months of testing, tasting, and revising, Mike and Nick ended up with a concentrated formula that actively fought bacteria, plaque, and tartar for up to 8 hours, and would be able to pack 60 uses into a single 1.62-ounce bottle. And of course, it tasted fantastic. Since they were transforming oral care by making it accessible on the fly, they decided to call their product Fly Mouthwash. The name is also a nod to the fact that it's a TSA-approved product and perfect for those who fly often. Once they finally found the winning compound, it was time to locate a manufacturer. This seemed like it would be the easiest part of the process, since they had a clear vision for packaging, a small bottle similar to the one that inspired the product, along with a narrow opening at the top. The search turned out to be harder than expected. They couldn't afford to purchase orders in the large numbers the manufacturers were asking for. Eventually, they found a company in Ohio that would let them start with 7,000 units. Still a big commitment for them, but one that was manageable. All in all, $20,000 of their hard-earned cash went toward getting Fly mouthwash to the masses. It wasn't pocket change, but when they had the physical product in their pocket, they knew it was worth it. As for the pricing, they figured that since each of their mini bottles contained 60 uses, it made sense to price them around $10 each, or 16 cents per use. Within the first 6 weeks, they'd already sold 1,400 bottles, all with spending only a few hundred dollars on ads. They got started by selling on Amazon, which was a fantastic way to prove their concept, but it also came with challenges. Crucially, there was no way for them to collect any data on the people who were purchasing their product, making it virtually impossible for them to narrow down who their ideal customer was. And for the few ads they did pay for, there was no real way of telling whether a click-through led to a sale or which of the ads did better than any other. The second and third months of operation were dedicated to building a website and e-commerce platform. By the time we featured them on Cytosol School a few months later, they'd sold more than half of their stock of Fly mouthwash, all within their first 6 months. Next, they tried shifting to a subscription model, offering a club where frequent buyers get a new shipment each month in exchange for a small fee. To their surprise, 50 people signed up over the first weekend they offered it. Mike says that for every individual sale, they're now bringing in 5 new monthly subscribers to their Fresh Breath Club. They've also been able to give back. Fly mouthwash has partnered with water.org to provide safe water for people in the developing world. For every bottle sold, they make a donation that allows local nonprofits to provide safe water to one person for 1 month. These days, the mouthwash mavens are looking to move away from marketing their product as merely a portable option and are instead looking to replace traditional mouthwash entirely. With funding recently secured from an outside investor who was interested in their product, mouthwash greatness seems to be inevitable. They're restoring confidence and freshening up the world, one mouth at a time. Critical factor. Mouthwash hadn't seen much innovation in more than a century. Mike and Nick are creating a fresh and clean, portable alternative to existing products. Fashion buyer creates quirky comfort craze. He always had a unique and edgy taste in fashion. Thanks to a BuzzFeed article forwarded by a friend, he's been able to create a brand that appeals to other people like him. Kyle Bergman never anticipated that reading BuzzFeed on his office computer would have an impact on his life beyond passing the time. But thanks to the recommendation of a friend, it gave him the idea for a most unusual side hustle. Around the Bloomingdale's offices, where he worked as a men's fashion buyer, Kyle wasn't afraid to take risks. He was the guy who would turn up on casual Fridays in a Hawaiian shirt when everyone else wore button-downs and jeans. Because of this quirkiness, one of his colleagues forwarded him a BuzzFeed article she thought he would appreciate. The article was all about a new fashion craze that combined sweatpants and overalls, and Kyle was sold on the concept as soon as he saw it. But he was also disappointed. The entire article featured women's sweatpant overalls, and he wanted a pair for himself. When he got home from work, he spent the entire evening scouring the internet trying to find a pair of these overalls for men. But to his dismay, there were none. As a last-ditch effort, he decided to look on Alibaba, where he found a single factory drawing of male sweatpant overalls. But because the factory was targeted at retailers, he'd have to order at least 300 units. It seemed he was out of luck. Over the next 8 months, Kyle kept the unconventional overalls at the back of his mind, but never did anything about them. It was only when he started studying for an MBA at NYU that he decided to take action. He logged back into Alibaba and sent a message to Mandy, the Chinese supplier who first told him he'd need to order 300 units. He asked about ordering a sample, and when she quoted him $150 for a single pair, he felt disappointed yet again. It would be another 6 months before Kyle finally responded to that quote and bought a sample from her. He managed to negotiate her down to a lower price of $111, merely by jumping on the phone and asking for it. He put in an order, and a few weeks later, he received his prototype. That prototype exceeded his expectations. The fit was good, and it looked like a premium product. Altogether, the experience gave him the resolve to move forward with his business idea. He called up Mandy the supplier again, asking for some changes to make the product look more manly, with thicker straps, a more masculine bib, and a jogging pants cuff. He also gave her a sizing guide based on his measurements, because he was the typical large size for a male. She made these alterations for free, and 6 weeks later, he received a finished product that met the requirements. Then came the biggest step of all, putting in an order of 500 units at a per-unit cost of $16.40. Combining this with his other expenses brought his total startup cost to around $25,000. Not cheap, but he believed in the product. Kyle began looking at different ways he could sell his new all-in-one apparel item and settled on the Fulfillment by Amazon program. By choosing this option, he could send his product to one of Amazon's warehouses directly, where they'd store it and deal with orders, shipping, and any returns. He'd pay a 15% commission and a $5 flat fee on each unit he sold from the warehouse. It seemed like the most viable option for Kyle to keep his potentially high upfront investment down. In order to use this system, he had to be an official business, not just a sole proprietor. He discovered that registering his business as an LLC, or limited liability company, was as simple as contacting his state's small business registry, giving his company a name, and paying a fee of $250. Kyle called it the Great Fantastic, after a phrase his mother had used. He chose an equally hipster-esque name for his product, calling them Swoveralls. He set the price for a pair of Swoveralls at $85. In making this decision, he factored in the cost of making the product and storing it with Amazon, which came to $37.15, and looked at the competitive market for other on-trend products. This meant he was selling at a competitive retail price, but still making a 56% profit margin on his product. To get to market, Kyle created a tongue-in-cheek style of branding that he modeled on the Chubby Swim Shorts brand. It's playful and funny, adding to the quirky nature of the Swoveralls themselves. He applied this style to his online communication to try to bring in new customers to his business. He also reached out to people in his network, including friends who played lacrosse in their extended network, to find models who would pose wearing his product. The major portion of Kyle's first sales came from his mailing list. However, this wasn't a mailing list in the traditional sense. Instead, he manually compiled a list of over 700 people he had personally met who he felt might be interested in his new product. He reached out to them, all of them, one at a time, on the day that he launched the product. This intensive outreach effort was met with a strong response, bringing in a few thousand dollars in orders before the day ended. However, Kyle's biggest break was when one of his friends got the product featured in an article in Thrillist, another popular news site. The article about his overalls went viral and began getting picked up by local media and blogs all over the world. Luckily, by then he had set up a website using Shopify to refer all those people to. This combination of networking, branding, and reaching out to his old contacts helped Kyle to make over $65,000 in year one, ending up with $24,000 of profit. Who said men's sweatpant overalls were a risky proposition? Critical factor. Whoever would have thought of a men's overalls plus sweatpants combo? No one but Kyle, apparently. Getting investors amped just takes a little jamming. A Toronto science teacher and musician creates an attachable guitar amplifier that pairs with a smartphone for improvised jam sessions wherever you are. Anyone who teaches kids how to make Lego robots and plays in a band called Death Valley Yacht Club is going to be an interesting and curious person. So it's not surprising that Toronto science teacher Chris Prendergast created the Jamstack, a lightweight, easily attached guitar amplifier that works with a smartphone. The Jamstack gives musicians a simple way to practice while incorporating custom sounds and tracks from smartphone apps into the mix. Chris had grown increasingly frustrated with the effort and hassle of setting up amps and other equipment whenever he wanted to play electric guitar. And because of his teaching duties, where he helps kids with those Lego robotics, he was comfortable tinkering with electronics. The tinkering led to a side hustle worthy of the greatest hair bands. Chris created a modular amp that fits on the bottom of guitars. The amp includes a mount for a smartphone and all the necessary cables. At less than 2 pounds, the setup is nothing like carting a bulky amp around, and it allows for playing along with other tracks, loops, and effects through a smartphone app. When you're finished jamming, you can also share the tunes online. But wait, there's more. The Jamstack is portable enough to fit in a guitar case for all your busking needs. It runs up to 8 hours on a charge, and it works with all major smartphones. At 10 watts, the speaker has plenty of power and fidelity to sound great at high and low volumes. It can even double as a portable Bluetooth speaker. In short, the Jamstack is the Ginzu knife of portable amps. Side note, the only question is, can you turn it up to 11? Perhaps Chris will add this feature in a future version. Because the phone is mounted right on the guitar, players can set up loops and perform samples on the fly, whether they're jamming by themselves, practicing with other band members, or performing in a small setting. Using the right apps, the device can recreate virtually any guitar sound without the need for bulky and expensive computer gear. The Jamstack can also be used just as a small amplifier without a smartphone, although it won't play that perfect Stairway to Heaven solo for you. Less than a year after developing the concept, Chris built a prototype and launched crowdfunding projects on Kickstarter and Indiegogo. The Indiegogo campaign surpassed $250,000 in pre-orders, and the device is now being shipped to backers after being manufactured in China. Just before Indiegogo, he won $10,000 in the Canadian Music Week Startup Launchpad Pitch Competition, granting him one-on-one access to lawyers and record company officials who work with licensing. Finally, he pitched Jamstack on Dragon's Den, the original Shark Tank. Although he didn't end up taking the offer they made, he says he learned a good deal about how investors think. As for what's next, his future seems harmonious. Even though he's busy with robots and rehearsals for Death Valley Yacht Club, he's also twanging out ideas for new hardware and software. Keep your ears open for the next big thing. Critical factor. The Jamstack comes ready to rock, allowing musicians to jam, practice, and even perform without the need to cart a bulky amplifier everywhere they go. It also brings new meaning to the phrase plug and play. Perfect pillowcases produce dreamy profits for TechWorker. Tired of battling split ends and hair breakage, an exhausted tech employee switches to satin pillowcases. She then learns to make and sell her own, earning six figures annually. For nearly a decade, Dale Janay worked for a commercial real estate company in San Francisco. It wasn't a dream job, but it met her basic needs. To pursue other interests, Dale started a fashion and lifestyle blog featuring clothing reviews, tips on getting legs like J-Lo's, and lessons in making classic Italian cocktails. This project was fun and somewhat profitable. She got paid for occasional sponsored posts, but she mostly considered it a form of mental escape. The long days and stressful city life, along with some dating drama, led to her feeling frazzled. And her hair was frazzled too. Dale's aunt was a hairdresser. During a visit, she noticed a lot of split ends and breakage and recommended sleeping on a hand-sewn satin pillowcase. After just a single night on the new pillowcase, Dale noticed a difference in her hair and skin. Satin really was the miracle fabric. But it was hard to find a high-quality satin pillowcase. So, as one does, she set out to make her own. She called her idea Savvy Sleepers. Through a friend, she met a woman from Shanghai with multiple connections to factories producing high-end bedding brands, including Pottery Barn. A month later, she flew to China with her sister and best friend, who was fluent in Mandarin. They went to factory towns and tested over 200 satin blends to find the best quality and shades of color. They then designed the pillowcase, complete with a secret pocket embroidered with her new Savvy Sleepers logo. Initial startup costs, including ordering inventory, building an online store, and that in-person scouting trip, were around $11,000. Dale expected sales and orders to roll in like a flock of sheep ready to be counted. Unfortunately, some of those sheep must have taken a detour on the way to Dreamland. Within the first 6 months, she'd had just under $10,000 in sales. In a lot of our stories, those results would be stellar. But for Dale, they were discouraging. Yet, she persevered, and things began to turn around in the second and third years. Savvy Sleepers was featured in a beauty subscription box, which brought more attention. In turn, that feature led to more press coverage, causing additional spikes in sales. Sales continued to grow over the next 18 months, and in year three, she hit six figures, a baseline she stayed at ever since. As this side business continued to grow, Dale considered making a big change. Her employer was bought by a competitor, and a number of her coworkers were leaving. She had enough savings to last up to a year, even if Savvy Sleepers failed, so she made a careful plan to transition. That was 3 years ago, and she hasn't looked back. Dale's satin pillowcases are now available in the world's largest blow-dry bar chain, and also in hair salons and spas nationwide. Her next step involved international expansion, and her long-term goal is to make $1 million in annual sales. Was it all just a dream? No, this six-figure income is a reality that exists long after Dale wakes up from her savvy satin sleep. Critical factor, it works. Many people who try sleeping on a satin pillow notice an immediate difference in healthy hair and sometimes even their quality of sleep. Outdoorsman sinks hopes into boat in a backpack. A passion for the great outdoors leads a project manager to design and manufacture highly portable kayaks. Pete Flood has always enjoyed traveling, especially when it involves nature. Getting away from the crowds and up to the mountains, lakes, and rivers is his refuge from everyday life. He spent many a trip camping, fishing, and scuba diving from the Bahamas to Alaska, and he wanted a boat that could make exploring these hard-to-reach places a little easier. For years, he would wake up in the middle of the night thinking about how to get to the next place. thinking of a slightly different way to design this boat. It would have to be light, versatile, and easy to assemble. And it would help if he could carry it like a backpack. Unfortunately, this boat of his dreams existed only in those dreams. After years of living with an active imagination, Pete took a trip to the hardware store. He purchased PVC pipe, glue, and some fittings. Then he began what turned into a long process filled with trial and error. Fortunately, he was patient. Since Pete has a full-time job as a senior project manager for a software company, he spent his nights and weekends, off and on for a couple of years, building over 20 prototypes until he was happy. Before he showed it to anyone other than his wife, he made sure to get it patented. With his patent filed and a prototype in hand, Pete headed to the outdoor retailer market in Salt Lake City. While at the event, he landed an important meeting with someone who helped him see that even after all those revisions, his design was problematic and needed more work. Another inventor might have given up, but Pete ditched the design he brought to the show and started over. Completing another 20-plus revisions, he invented an even better design for what he calls his K-Pack folding boat. This new design allowed the boat to go from completely packed to ready for the water in 4 minutes. After patenting this new design, Pete needed to find a manufacturer who could bring the prototype to retail reality. This led him on a 3-year quest around the country from New York to California to Virginia. Pete eventually made 3 trips to China, trying to find a manufacturer that would work with him. Ultimately, he ended up going with a Chinese manufacturer. After more than 5 years of dreaming, the first round of K-Pack boats was shipped to Pete back home in North Carolina. The end of one successful chapter meant the beginning of another. Now that he had a product in hand, it was time to market it and get these boats out into the hands of adventurers. Pete started by creating a website that included lots of photos and videos demonstrating just how easy the boat was to set up. He set up the usual social media channels and a way to process payments. He also approached some outdoor stores about stocking his boats, but soon realized that it wasn't a good fit. Unlike other boats, Pete's boat in a backpack requires a bit of explanation. The average consumer in a store would see a black backpack, and then an assembled boat, and have to make a mental leap to connect the two. And since it sells for just under $900, it's not exactly an impulse buy. Not only that, but Pete's boats don't require anything other than a paddle and a life jacket. Any other boat usually requires a variety of other products, including a bailer pump, a skirt, a cart, and a lift system to help store it. Outdoor stores would miss out on these additional sales with Pete's boat, so they were resistant. With his knowledge in hand, he focused on selling direct. Pete hired a marketing manager to help him beef up his online presence. They also started to narrow down their potential markets by doing some focus groups. One of their first target markets came as a surprise to Pete. Urban women who head to the outdoors on the weekend became some of his most active buyers. When it comes to finances, this hasn't been a $100 startup or cheap side hustle. Getting it going required more than $200,000 spread out across many years. About $100,000 went toward the first production run, and the rest went toward the patent process, materials for his dozens of prototypes, sourcing all the different materials required, traveling around the country to find a manufacturer, and creating a setup for outdoor shows. Here's the key point. By keeping his day job throughout the 10-year startup process, Pete was able to invest in his boat dream without stressing over how he'd pay the bills. The job enabled the side hustle to get started and eventually become profitable. Pete is a perpetual inventor and tinkerer. He's already come up with a new butterfly design that will shave minutes off the already quick setup. He's recently been hitting the outdoor shows again, trying to find partners so that he can sell his boat in as many channels as possible. But first, he has another adventure trip booked. When we last spoke with him, he was heading off to Norway with his wife to celebrate 30 years of marriage. Naturally, the boat in a backpack was going with them. Critical factor, this wasn't a quick, cheap, or easy success. But by remaining at his job, Pete was able to build his invention and see it to market without the pressure of depending on the income. Engineer designs break-in tool after getting locked out of apartment. After being locked out of his home one too many times, this curious engineer develops a tool to carry in a wallet. In year one, he sells 50,000 units. Nate Barr's hustle began after he locked himself out of his apartment. Again. He had just run out to pick up something at the corner store when he realized he'd brought his wallet, but forgotten his keys. As he was waiting in the cold for someone to come let him in, an idea came to him. If he only had some sort of metal shim, he thought, he might be able to get the door latch open. He also thought how convenient it would be if he had a bottle opener on him at all times, because a man never knows when he might be called upon to open a bottle. And of course, having such a tool available at all times meant that it would have to fit into his wallet. Once he got back in his house, he immediately started thinking about what this tool might look like and what other things he could fit in there. He wanted it to be super thin and feel like a credit card so that he could carry it with him by default. With the general idea in place, Nate made a list of all the things that would be cool or useful to have on this tool. He knew it wouldn't necessarily be a replacement for a pocket knife, but he wanted it to be super functional. He used free open source software to work on the design during evenings and weekends. A couple of weeks and about 100 iterations later, Nate came up with a design that packed as many tools as possible into one tiny metal cart. It had that metal shim and bottle opener he'd thought about the night he was stranded in the cold, a pair of screwdrivers, a hex wrench, a phone kickstand, a headphone wrap, and about half a dozen other features. At the last minute, he'd added a stenciled monkey into the design, which served a couple of purposes. First, it looked pretty cool. Second, it made the product protectable under trademark law. He called his new tool the Pocket Monkey. With a functional yet aesthetically pleasing design completed, he was ready to test it out. For the first trial, he just cut the design out of cardboard and made sure that it felt right in his hands while doing each function. From there, he sent the design to a group that does laser cutting in metal so that he could test it on a material slightly closer to the end product. Once he'd refined the metal prototype to the point he was confident it would work, it was time for a Kickstarter campaign. Nate decided to try crowdfunding the product for a couple of reasons. First, it would give him some capital to create the product in larger quantity. But just as important, he wanted to make sure there was really a market for his idea. Asking people to put down their money in the form of advance commitments seemed like the best way to test this question. Since the end of the year was drawing near, Nate hurried and launched his Kickstarter before he felt completely ready, knowing that the Pocket Monkey would be perfect for holiday presents. The campaign launched on November 30th, and by December 14th, it had over 1,900 backers. Nate raised over $27,000 on Kickstarter and an additional $20,000 on his own newly created website. Nate was encouraged by the enthusiasm for the campaign. His enthusiasm slowed, however, when he realized he had been overconfident in the time it would take to produce the tool in bulk. He promised that the finished product would be in customers' hands by Christmas, a promise that proved impossible to keep. As he called factory after factory, he heard the same story. Each manager would politely hear him out and then tell him that it wasn't the right fit for the type of metalwork they do. Almost everyone gave him a referral to another manufacturer that might be able to help him out, so he kept calling around. The project continued to stall even when he thought he'd found the right partner. Whenever someone was willing to work with him, he'd get them the design files and then spend more time going back and forth about various details. But then he wouldn't hear anything for a while. Finally, they'd admit that they hit a roadblock and wouldn't be able to deliver. This happened multiple times where he spent hours modifying his design, thinking he'd found his manufacturer, only to learn that his new partner couldn't handle the job. It took him 5 months after launching the crowdfunding campaign to find a partner who would actually produce his Pocket Monkey. This meant his promised Christmas delivery turned into the next year, with Pocket Monkeys going out in batches as he received them from his manufacturer, extending all the way into June. He still delivered the goods, but the timing wasn't ideal. The experience got Nate thinking about two things. First, how he could control more of the manufacturing process himself, and second, what other products he could make that would fit into this brand. He knew that making just one product and launching it in a campaign wouldn't change his life overnight, so he wanted to keep expanding the brand. But before he could do that, he needed a steady stream of revenue. Nate took his remaining income from the Kickstarter campaign and spent it all on getting himself to a trade show in New York City. Including the rental and staging of a pricey booth at the show, the trip cost more than $10,000. It was a risk, but the decision turned out to be a wise investment. At that one show, retailers from all across the country placed orders. With some predictable income in place, Nate was able to hire a couple of employees to run the business while he was still working his 9-to-5 job as a software engineer. It wasn't until 2 years later that he felt comfortable enough to quit his day job and devote all his energy to growing further. Part of this was because he did everything he could to control his own manufacturing process. As he described it, we slowly started swimming upstream in our supply chain and began acquiring more and more machines. First the polisher, then the laser engraver, and on up until we had everything we needed to make the products in-house. Having the ability to do almost everything himself made it much easier to launch new products because he could do the bulk of the work himself. This innovation helped Zootility, the name of his new company, begin making real money. Nate was able to continue to bring on more people while sticking to his ideals, manufacturing and creating jobs in the United States, while creating a high-quality, functional product at a competitive price point. And he's managed to keep doing this. He's now up to 18 employees and dozens of products. To date, Nate has sold over 500,000 Pocket Monkeys alone, and he has no plans to slow down. He recently launched a line of tool jewelry called Toolery, and has more ideas in the prototyping and percolating stages. Looking back, he's glad he didn't take his keys with him that cold November day in Maine. He's also glad he followed up on his crazy idea. Critical factor. Nate's tiny tool can accomplish dozens of tasks, but it all fits in your wallet or phone case. He also sells them in bulk on his website. A smart move, since the price point is so low. Side Hustle Labs, importing products from overseas. If you're ready to take the plunge, or just dip your toe in the Pacific Ocean of reselling, you might want to take a look at the behemoth of factory listings, Alibaba.com. Upon visiting Alibaba, you'll encounter thousands of product listings, complete with prices, terms of purchase, and reviews of the manufacturer from other customers. The simplest and easiest way to get started is to select some kind of product line to experiment with. Yoga mats, remote-controlled tractors, adjustable cat furniture, it's all there on Alibaba. Just be aware that browsing the site is an easy way to lose an entire afternoon. You'll likely be more successful if you find some way to brand the items you buy. Matthew Konstanecki's anti-mosquito wristbands were made to include the name Invisiband on them. Another popular Side Hustle School story featured a guy who made $300,000 reselling manual coffee grinders on Amazon. The only physical difference between his product and other generic ones was a line of text that included his business name. The real value came in the way he interacted with his customers. Finally, you can also hire a manufacturer to custom build a product for you, just like several of the stories featured here. Download a list of questions to ask potential partners at sidehustleschool.com/factory. Chapter 15, Ramp Up, $1 Million Side Hustles. Side hustles are great for earning extra cash, and sometimes they earn a lot of it. These stories represent people with hustles that produce high six figures or seven figures in annual income. Chicago woman hangs out with Etsy-inspired business. A Chicago-based plastic recycling sales rep transforms her love for DIY lampshades into a multi-million dollar business. Jennifer Brown has been starting projects since she was 10 years old, beginning with selling Beanie Babies on eBay and dog sitting for $30 per day. In high school, she tried repainting abandoned furniture from an alleyway. Then, in college, she found her stride and took her creativity to the next level. At a local craft show, Jen saw a liquor bottle with lights inside of it. Always looking for her next DIY project, she decided to make one for herself. Once she'd placed Christmas lights inside a painted liquor bottle, her friends kept asking her to sell them one. So, like any resourceful artist, she followed through on their requests. Then, one day, she tried something else. Jen covered a balloon in Elmer's glue and wrapped it with yarn to create a lampshade. She had never seen anything like it. That very same day, a good friend told her about the online marketplace called Etsy. Within a week, Jen had listed her creation and made her first sale for $60. She sold a second lampshade a few days later for another $40. With a $300 rent payment looming, $100 was a significant amount of money. What excited her most was that she was just getting started. What would happen if she invested more of her time and efforts in making more fixtures? She began looking around for other things on Etsy that she could create. She saw some wooden chandeliers and, much like the lighted liquor bottles, thought, hey, I can make those too. Not only did her bedroom transform into her production studio, but sometimes she couldn't use her shower because she had hung so many yarn spears in there to dry. Every time she received a customer request for a new color, she would make it for them, take a picture, and add it as another item in her store. This organic growth was wonderful, but one can only make so many yarn lampshades. As she was quickly outgrowing the limited production capacity of her bathroom, Jen decided it was time to charge more. In a story as old as time, the more she raised her prices, the more she sold. Years later, she still recalls the moment she realized she could turn $10 in supplies into a $300 light fixture. For years, her DIY lighting hustle was just a side gig as she worked her day job as a sales rep at a recycling company. In fact, it was the job that had made selling on Etsy so easy. Her background in sales, marketing, graphic design, and search engine optimization, or SEO, put her leaps and bounds above other home crafters selling their wares at the time. Since Jen could work from home a few days per week, everybody told her not to quit her day job. For years, she dutifully maintained the status quo, working full-time and selling her wares on the side. That is, until one day, when a friend asked her to question the opportunity cost of continuing to keep both jobs. Quick side note, Jen also mentioned that she never understood the risk that everyone said she was taking in walking away from her job. As she saw it, remaining at the job would have been a much bigger risk. With that change in perspective, hangout lighting became more of a priority. Jen knew that she couldn't continue to grow the business if she was building lights all day long, so she began to consider hiring employees to help out. Going all in allowed Jen to brighten up hangout lighting sales to multiple six figures. What started as a side hustle now gives Jen total financial and schedule freedom. The Etsy side of Hangout Lighting grew to $1 million in sales in just 3 years. Between her various online channels, she now brings in up to $70,000 per month. While she could be taking home large profits per month, Jen reinvests much of it back into the business. She does this, as she puts it, to continue growing my dreams. By pursuing those dreams, her bright ideas have brightened up thousands of homes. Critical factor. Jen applied marketing smarts to DIY crafts and then carefully built on her initial success by hiring the right employees and reinvesting in the business. Renegade Museum tour guide earns $2 million. A New York City man goes on a forgettable date, but falls in love with the idea of creating his own museum tour company. Several years ago, on a Saturday night in December, Nick Gray was on what was supposed to be a romantic date. He and his companion were taking a private tour of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. As snow fell outside over New York City, they traveled through the Met's dimly lit hallways and cavernous rooms filled with sculptures, paintings, and Egyptian artifacts. According to Nick, that night something magical happened. He fell in love with the museum. As for the date, that relationship didn't work out. In fact, he barely remembers her. Instead, he remembers being entranced by the artworks all around him, documenting more than 5,000 years of human history. These observations quickly turned into an obsession. While Nick spent his working weeks selling avionics equipment, a job he was happy with, he started spending every weekend at the Met. He began offering free tours of the museum to his friends and family, which mainly consisted of showing them his favorite things. He says he was having so much fun doing the tours that the first time someone tried to offer him $20 at the end, he turned it down. As word spread of his skill, the off-hours tours began consuming more and more of his time. Given his newfound love for museums and desire to share it, he decided to set up a side business. His idea was to offer non-traditional renegade tours at the world's best museums. By this point, he had increased the quality of his tours using library research, as well as turning to the trusted friend of every student who's written a paper in the past 15 years, Wikipedia. His friends started telling their friends, and the word continued to spread. At one point, a blog wrote about his tours, and the next day, Nick received hundreds of requests to sign up. He officially launched his company, Museum Hack, a few months later, offering public tours for $59 a person and private tours for $99 a person. The setup was simple. Nick financed almost all of his startup costs, including a website, by charging for the tours. And he attracted most of his customers simply through word of mouth. After guests went on the tours, they would post about them online, creating additional interest. He also started hiring part-time guides, who now include Broadway actors, stand-up comedians, and scientists. These guides design their own routes based on what they're most passionate about. The museum benefits too. Museum Hack pays them an admission fee for each guest. The goal is to tap into a whole new market of museum goers, essentially people who think they hate museums, a group which, Nick admits, used to include him. His tours are 2 to 3 times faster than traditional ones, incorporate games throughout, and reveal the juicy gossip behind the paintings and other exhibits. One of the taglines he uses is, "This isn't your grandma's museum tour." In fact, one of the most popular tours that Museum Hack offers is the consistently sold-out Badass Bitches Tour, a feminist celebration of women in the Met. It's safe to say that all this touring has been a huge success. In its first year, Museum Hack made about $40,000. In the following year, income increased 12-fold to just under $500,000. About 2 years after launching the tours, Nick's side hustle officially became his full-time gig. He still liked his day job, but running a part-time project of this size was like painting the Sistine Chapel at night while working as a bank teller during the day. At last count, Museum Hack has led over 21,000 people on semi-private tours in 5 cities. The business has 60-plus employees, as well as contractors and associates, who regularly do tours and events, along with a leadership team that keeps everything running smoothly. As the team expanded, Nick made another big change, promoting his chief of staff to take over his job as CEO. He continues to be highly involved, but he felt like someone more focused on process and organization would be better suited at the helm. Accordingly, he's shifting his focus to an advisory role and looking for more creative ways to expand the business even further. A side hustler at heart, Nick is already busy with a new hobby, this time hosting a pioneering style of cocktail parties. Naturally, he's testing it out on his friends first. Critical factor. Museum tours for people who hate museums proved to be a powerful selling point. Then, as Nick branched out and began to hire guides,